I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Available seasonally at select Whole Foods markets. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jim Carbone. I'm the host. It's Wednesday, March 12th, 2024. So we're back at the Mothership Studio in Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. And we've got a special group here. We're going to talk about corn, Mexico, whiskeys, and some other things. So, guys, let's go around the room and introduce yourselves.
Hey, I'm Clay Risen. I'm a reporter for the New York Times, and I write about whiskey and other spirits for the paper and in books and all kinds of other venues.
And you wrote a really interesting article about Mexican corn
and
whiskey.
Wrote it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's interesting, but if you say so.
I'm Zach Wangeman from Sobremasa Restaurant and also Tortilla Factory.
And you're a heritage corn guy, right?
I'm a corn nerd, yes.
Trying to set the stage. Corn, whiskeys, and?
I am Tiffany Collings. I am a founder of Las Chingonas Imports. I do not do much with whiskey yet, but I do a lot with mezcal in Mexico. So very excited to be here. Thank you, Jimmy, for having me.
You know, Clay, we've had you on the show a few times. Years ago, you first came on, we talked about brown ales. And then your book about Teddy Roosevelt, we were trying to figure out what this U.S. soldiers in 1898 were eating, whether it was hardtack or bacon or the beers they were drinking in Florida. But it's great to have you back.
Man. Oh, thanks, man. It's always fun to be here.
You know, you've been a big deal in the world of whiskey with your rye book. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, I've written a bunch of books now about whiskey, and my most recent one was a book about American rye whiskey, just kind of telling the story of where it came from. It is the original American spirit, going back long before the Revolution. But it's also reviews and kind of assessments of whiskeys that are out there, trying to help people make sense of what they should buy when they go into a liquor store. So it's a little bit of service journalism, a little bit of history, a little bit of fun.
And Zach, what was interesting about your article, it was called Mexican Whiskey is on the Rise, Powered by Ancient Corn. There's so many great spirits coming out of Mexico. I have never really done a show on nor tasted many corn whiskeys. But what I liked was your connection between the corn as the ingredient and the techniques and just how these corns coming out of, the whiskeys coming out of Mexico with heritage corns are completely different than the bourbons, which you love and know are. So that's kind of where I want to go with this in the beginning. So Zach, rather than having a general conversation about Mexican spirits, because I know that Tiffany is here, an expert on that, Zach is too. Zach, you brought in some of the Mexican whiskey and corn whiskey. Tell us about that role on your bar for you, the corn and heritage corn. I'm babbling, but it gets edited, don't worry.
One of the things that a lot of people don't realize about corn is that it doesn't grow by itself. It needs human intervention to grow. What that means is that if a man, a person, a woman doesn't grab that seed and plant it, it will never grow on its own. Oldest varietals of corn are 7,000-8,000 years old. So that's over 150 generations of people planting these seeds, passing them on generation to generation. And so what we have now is a variety of seeds, and we like to call them native seeds because it involves not just them being old seeds, but it involves the community as well. So we like to use the term native seeds because of that, because it really symbolizes not just not just the seed of like the plant it is, but also the culture and the palate of the people where it grew, because they were able to craft that seed to their personal taste. You know, like I always give the example of in Oaxaca, it's such a soupy cuisine. All the tortillas, all the corn varieties there are a little bit harder than from, for instance, Tlaxcala, where they like a soft tortilla. They're a lot higher in starch. At Sobremasa, we're really in love with this concept. We're really in love with this diversity and with this patrimony from the people that grow these corns. And we really think that just like any vehicle, whether it's a tortilla or a whiskey, is worthy of it. But I think one thing's for sure is that these seeds are something that's not necessarily talked about, not necessarily recognized. You know, people aren't really getting that excited about corn as they are, you know, let's say, I don't know, Parmesan cheese. Or
you are. I am. One reason I invite you on is you are the corn guy. And in your last year for Bowl is All, you already bring in the hominy from Tomoa and you distributed it to all the restaurants. I mean, I've had tamales for lunch at your place. Tell us about Masa and that role in your restaurant.
So there's so much infrastructure going on in it that has to be put in place that we want in the restaurant just to have a good tortilla in New York City, from, you know, talking to the right importers to the machinery, that it is actually very easy to just start selling it as well to other restaurants. But we're all about trying to just celebrate this diversity. I was reading in your article, you work with a lot of Ehup, or you talked a lot about Ehu from the Yucatan, which is very cool. And that's actually a variety we're going to start working with next year. But we're not really picky about any variety. We're more about just trying to promote the diversity of it and try to showcase as many different flavors of the different corns. So what we do at the restaurant is we'll basically, you know, get a bunch of corn and we'll take it through a process called nixtamalization, which is a very ancient process of treating the corn with water and letting it essentially soak in an alkaline solution that'll break down the skin and it'll make it making the nutrients available for us. And the other thing it'll do is it'll also give us strength and pliability to turn it into masa for when we grind it. And yeah, that's a little bit of what we do with corn at the restaurant. And we make tortillas, we make tortilla chips, we make tamales. We'll do that for the restaurant. We'll sell some of that too as well. And it's really cool one of the cool things is like, I mean, we'll give a restaurant the masa, but really what they do with it is a lot of them get really, really, really creative with what they do. You know, they've done like really creative twills or like cakes or, you know, at the restaurant, we'll just grind it into a corn flour and we'll use it for dusting in general for like making croquettes or chicken wings, stuff like that, to keep it gluten free. So it's really cool. Just the versatility, which I still think is
Zach, what does really Sobremasa mean?
Sobremasa means about masa, which is, so it's about the corn dough essentially, which is masa.
And you're right down the street here on Harrison.
Yeah. Like three it's blocks great. Away. Very
good. Tiffany, just quick intro for you, how you got involved in importing Mexican spirits?
Well, sure. I got involved with Mexican spirits by basically going to Mexico and drinking a lot. I'm a professional alcoholic, as I like to call myself, but started working with just a couple of brands out of Guerrero in Mexico. And then slowly we expanded our portfolio to have, right now we have 14, including a rum and a liqueur. No whiskeys, no corn whiskeys yet. But I would like to add, I am from Indiana, home of the biggest whiskey manufacturing in the United States. Something I didn't know until kind of recently. And my family actually produced corn my whole life, but not anything very exciting or good for whiskey. It's animal feed.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, Clay, just now that we've introduced each other, I mean, this article is why we're all here. And what brought you to Mexico and corn whiskey? I mean, you wrote about rye and bourbons.
Yeah. Well, so I pay attention to what's out there, right? And as right now, a lot of countries are making whiskey. You know, you got French whiskey and Spanish whiskey and Japanese whiskey and Taiwanese. And there's some really great whiskeys out there. But aside from kind of the US, Canada, Ireland, most people are making Scotch clones, right? They're making malt-based whiskey using basically the same way they make whiskey in Scotland. And what struck me about some of the stories I was hearing out of Mexico was that they were doing something very different. And while it's corn-based, much like bourbon, it's very different. And not superficially different. I think different on a fundamental level. And so for me, when I looked at everything that was going on in the world, Mexican corn whiskey, I think, is really exciting. I think what they're doing there in terms of the heritage, in terms of the process, in terms of really making something that's grain forward. You know, I think a lot of whiskey these days, particularly internationally, is very barrel focused. It's very, very much focused on the production side, and that's fine. But here is a style of whiskey making that's very focused on the grain, bringing out the flavors in the grain, bringing out some of the traditions and the heritage heritage production that gives, you know, like nixtamalization, that give Mexican corn products their flavor. And how do you represent that in a liquid? And so I thought that's really cool. And this fundamental idea, and this is just something that I'm fascinated with generally, is this idea that there's a real terroir to whiskey if you want it to be. If you want to have a whiskey that's very expressive of a certain variety, that's expressive of a particular place, a culture, you can do that. And that goes against a lot of what people have thought about whiskey for a long time. But I think that's very much just the ideology of kind of commodity capitalism. And actually, if you go and you look at what you can do when you do like what these folks, what a lot of the distilleries in Mexico are doing and saying, no, we're going to look at a particular variety and we're going to look at particular cultural traits and heritages and we're going to try to emphasize that in the liquid, you really can. And you can produce something that's unique to your place and your agriculture. So all of that just made me really excited about what's going on there.
Yeah. And Tiffany, you know, when you guys go into Mexico, some of the brands you import, how would you define your ethos of like what you're looking for, the communities you're finding?
Sure. I would say we're looking for producer-owned brands. We're looking for really the story, the heart behind it. I always say if there isn't a person behind the bottle, then we're not interested. You can do a lot with branding, you can do a lot with marketing, but we want there to be something behind it. So there's always a story to be told. That's what we're hoping to find. Like I said, we just launched a rum and a liqueur, and the rum is actually a family-owned distillery that has been producing Piloncillo-based rum and see themselves as one of the last defenders of that tradition, even though it's considered to be within maybe the larger rum community, not the finest type of rum to make, but we found it to be very beautiful and we're really excited to bring that to the market. So things like that, that are exciting, new, with a lot of heart behind it.
Zach, at Sobremasa, tell us the philosophy of your drinks. I mean, it's everything from Mexico, and then you're going to start tasting us. I know you brought in one of the corn whiskeys.
Woo!
Yeah.
That's really why we're here. So
I think it's the philosophy of the drinks, I think it's going to continue to evolve with how, you know, I think the market evolves, and especially like Tiffany is making it a lot easier for us, helping us make more stuff available. But basically we try to only work with Mexican spirits and just trying to, that same ethos that we had behind the corn of trying to promote the diversity of the corn, kind of like carried over with a beverage. And trying to promote the diversity of the Mexican beverages as well. And, you know, that just goes on beyond mezcal and tequila to raicilla, sotol, bacanora, you know, and now some really cool rum, some really cool gins that you're seeing, some really cool whiskeys. In a lot of the cases, I think, you know, we have to adapt. There isn't like, let's say, for instance, there isn't a lot of modifiers that are from Mexico. So like, I think a good example is there's this one that we use for our Negronis. It's like the only Amaro we could find from Mexico. And we weren't that crazy about it, but we age it in clay, in some clay pots that we have. And that kind of gave it a little bit of sweetness and rounded it out a little bit. And that's what we use now for like Negronis and stuff like that. So it's kind of always limiting our vocabulary has helped us kind of like just expand our our creativity in that regard. For our whiskey, we actually do a blend of almost all the brands you mentioned in your article. We do a blend of Abasolo and the three Sierra Nortes. And that's kind of like what we use for the whiskey and at the restaurant, because we, you know, there hasn't been like a particular like well whiskey from Mexico that doesn't necessarily exist yet. We're always trying to see how we can be creative in that sort to try to like use as much Mexican product as possible.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really cool with Mexican whiskey is not only is the production and the heritage and the story is different, but the flavor is fundamentally different. I mean, when you taste some of these spirits, you really do find and taste the grain coming forward. You can really Sierra Norte, you know, they make a variety, they make multiple lines based on different corn varieties. And so you can line them up and taste them. And it's almost, you know, it's almost an experiment. So you can see these were all grown in similar conditions under similar places. And yet they taste different because they are different varieties. And this is probably no surprise to people who know a thing or two about Mexican corn. But for people who are used to drinking whiskey based on yellow dent number two in the United States, it is eye-opening. And here in the States, people are only a few really forward-thinking progressive distilleries are playing around with different varieties. And so for us, it's still this weird thing. You mean there are different kinds of corn out there? And so it's I think really exciting. It can be challenging for a North American or, you know, a US or a Canadian palate to taste something from a Canadian corn variety because it's very grain forward. You know, it's not like a traditional whiskey where there's the barrel is the determinant factor. Here, you're really looking to get the most out of your grain that you can. And I find that beautiful as an idea. I love the spirits and the flavors. I think it's going to be transformative over time as more and more people in this country become familiar with this approach.
Yeah. I mean, when you wrote the article, tell us the process you go through. I mean, are you just have samples of the bottles in front of you?
For a couple of years, people send me samples and I sort of take notes and think about what's going on. And I was sort of aware of what was out there, including I have some friends who go to Mexico regularly and started telling me about, there are all these great agave spirits, but also people are doing some cool stuff with whiskey, right? So I started, start to hear things. And then it's just a matter of deciding, who do I talk to? How do I reach out? And because it's a U.S.-focused article or U.S.-centric, I look mostly at, who are the big names who are exporting to the U.S., right? And so it's Abasolo and Sierra Norte and Maíz Nación is about to, Gran Maizal is around. And so it was really picking those out and then trying to also emphasize the diversity, right? So Gran Maizal, they age only in clay pots, in these amphorae, that they source out of Oregon, their wine amphorae. And that gives it a little bit of texture from the vessel, but mostly it just lets the whiskey or the spirit speak. Whereas Gran Maizal, Maíz Nación, they use more traditional barrel aging, and that produces a different flavor profile. Although they still very much lean into the spirit itself, trying to emphasize bring that out. And so it was really kind of exploring those differences, and just kind of letting people know that this is out there. I mean, I really hope that American whiskey drinkers will see this in the bar or in a retail store and give it a shot, because I think it's a really exciting forefront of the whiskey world.
Clay, I'm thinking of some of the early New York craft distillers, mm-hmm. and how they approached selling a product made from corn before they had anything aged. I remember Kings County Distillery used to always have, they called it corn eau de vie. It was their distilled corn unaged, and they were selling that while they were getting their 5 years aged. Do you see any comparisons between the origins of craft spirits in the U.S. and what's going on with Mexican whiskey?
You know, it's I think, sure. In certain levels. I mean, obviously, these are all new companies. They're all new. They're creating a new style. I think that's maybe the difference, though, is that whereas a lot of craft distilleries in the U.S. were ultimately trying to do their own thing, but were very much kind of entering a field that was already pretty well laid out, American whiskey scene. With Mexican whiskey, that's not even a thing until recently. So what does that mean? What does it look like? Each distillery is able to kind of define itself and say, well, this is what it means. Or someone else says, this is what it means. There's no governing body that says, well, this is what Mexican whiskey has to be. So that's very exciting, but it's also, I would imagine, somewhat challenging because, well, what do you want it to be? What should it be? In the U.S., there are very strict rules around what whiskey is. In Mexico, not so much. And so how do you define that? And if you want to export, how do you fit within certain expectations? So yes, I think there are some real parallels to the way that early craft distillers approached what they were doing. But I think it's the exciting part is that it's very different.
Tiffany? She was bobbing her head.
I'm loving this. I will admit to not being the biggest lover of corn whiskey. I always say it's one of those things that I want to like, but I don't. I've had some that are enjoyable, but I think to your point, that's so interesting about this is creating this category that didn't exist and using these native corns that no one's ever done this before to create this category of Mexican whiskey is something really exciting. And I do think it's very nice. It's the struggle I have with it on my palate is sometimes it's a little sharper, if that makes sense. Like I feel it hits me in a different way. And I'm so used to drinking scotch that it hits in a different way. But once your palate adjusts to it, it is very sippable and nice, but I think maybe Zach could talk about what would you do in a cocktail or how are you like drinking this? Where's your brain going? Like, what would you do with this?
I would mix this with anything. I think it's delicious.
I'll have another one. And I think Sarah Strong's here too. I think she needs some too.
Oh, a little more.
It's the biggest struggle with the cocktails in a Mexican restaurant that you can put all this love behind this cocktail. And at the end of the day, people just want margaritas all day.
Not a corn whiskey and Coke.
What about, since we're talking, what about neat mezcal? So I was talking to Reed from Cuenta Cuentas last night. That's going to be another show coming out for Bowl Azul. And we were talking about the good mezcals or sippers.
Look, I'll tell you what. We have a cocktail right now. It's called Pinche Love. It's a mix of Abasolo and Sierra Norte Yellow and Tepache. So we make our own pineapple tepache with a little bit of pulque.
So you make it.
We make the tepache and we add a little bit of pulque to it as well.
Cool. Tell everybody what tepache is, because I've heard a lot of people saying, gosh, I wish someone could make a good tepache in America.
You know, tepache is kind of, it depends on who your grandma is, how you want to define it in Mexico. But usually it's a fermented beverage that has pineapple rinds in it is probably the main ingredient. And it can have anything else in there. You know, depending on your grandmother, you know, we at Sobremasa, we add apples.
So it's the scraps.
It's the scraps.
Yeah.
And usually, traditionally, it's fermented underground, which I think is pretty cool.
Wow.
And most recipes have a little bit of pulque to kickstart it. Pulque is like the original yeast of Mexico, I think. Like they used to add it in bread before you could just add commercial yeast to stuff. They'd always add a little pulque in it to help because it just ferments so beautifully. Tepache is, I guess you call it a pineapple beer, or wine, you know, just fermented pineapple skin.
It's not pasteurized. It's really meant to be made and served locally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Have you had it before?
I have not.
So Mexico is kind of new to you. That's why I was asking you about craft craft spirits in America. I was thinking about also like for my early whiskey education, which doesn't go back that far, maybe 2015. I remember there was Balcones in Texas, which had blue corn. I remember it tasting like this very fruity corn quality. Have you tried Balcones?
I have, yeah.
Are they still around?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're still around.
Excuse my...
No. They got bought by Diageo. Now owns them. So, no, but they're a great distillery. Yeah. There's a distillery down in Charleston called Highwire, and they're big advocates of corn varieties, using specific corn varieties. And so they have a specific corn. They work with a local branch of the Clemson University Agriculture Department, and they have a variety that called Jimmy Red, and they grow it in different places around South Carolina to show that, hey, the same variety grown in the low country versus up toward the Piedmont is going to taste different. And so they source it from different places, make a whiskey with those different variety, you know, different sources, and just to demonstrate, hey, this is how sensitive corn is if you treat it as a terroir specific grain instead of just lumping it all together. And they make, I mean, their whiskey is delicious. It's great. But it just goes to show. And they actually, the owners of Highwire are big fans of Mexican corn, Mexican distilleries, Mexican whiskeys. They're big advocates for this style.
Before I ask you about some of the roots of bourbon and corn-based whiskeys in America, I want to ask these guys, who's behind preserving all the different varieties of heritage corn in Mexico? I mean, there must be so much pressure to take on mainstream, you know, commodity crops. I know in Clay's article said there's at least 59 different varieties of corn. I've seen when we do Bolazol on the Tomoa bags. I mean, you've got quite at least 13 different, they call them land races, varieties of corn that are made for just their hominy.
There's a very strong community in Mexico, and hopefully it's just getting stronger. But I think, you know, that's one of our mission statements here at the restaurant is like, how can we be a part of that community in New York that has a larger voice for the world? But it's also something that we're learning all together. And there's also something that we're having challenges together. Like last year was really bad harvest. There's almost no rain, and you know, there are certain rules that we try to go by. Like, we only want to work with surplus, right? Because you don't want to take any food away from the farmers, and you also want to keep seeds for the next year. So there's also kind of like important rules that we have to follow. Maize Nation, you know, Jonathan has a really cool, that makes the Maize Nation whiskey. He has a really cool documentary you should see on native corn. But I think, you know, I think one of the most important things, and I used to be really like, oh, the varieties and preserve the varieties. But, you know, I think one of the most beautiful things about corn is that it can pollinate so easily and it can evolve so easily. It adapts so easily. I think that's one of the most beautiful things about it. And that's also what we want to preserve. And it's not so much, when I was first starting to learn about corn, I was kind of chasing the wrong thing. I want to learn about all the varieties, but the thing to preserve, I don't think, are the varieties. The thing to preserve is the culture of passing on that seed from generation to generation, and how can we promote that, and how can we keep that growing? I think there's some stuff that I start to see now that's kind of like, I think, developed into a pet peeve. And one of them is when you grab a seed from Mexico and then you bring it to the United States and then you plant it here, that stops being Mexican corn because it's evolved and it's adapted to American climate. And you can't call it that, because if you call it Mexican corn, you're tapping into the intellectual property of the farmers that grew this into Mexico. They don't know the value it has, and they'll never call you out for it. But I think that's something that's very, very important. You know, and, you know, if you want to bring those seeds, you know, I think that's fine, but you just can't call them, you know, Mexican seeds, because they're your own thing now.
Clay, in your article, it was mentioned that what terroir is. And it wasn't what we just think of as a grape on a certain plot of land in France. What did your interview say?
I think to pick up on what Zach was saying and what Jonathan Barbieri has said, so and put into his whiskey so forcefully, is that it is very much the people that make it. And so you know, when he sources his corn, it's not just a particular variety that he sources from whoever can get it. It's a specific community. It's a specific place. And he says, you know, look, it's not the same. If it comes, even if it's the same variety, but it comes from somewhere else, that's not going to be the whiskey that we want to make. We want to make, or we're not going to call it that whiskey. You know, we're not going to use that variety's name because it's so important that it comes from that community in that place. And so I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. And it's very hard sometimes, I think, for a U.S. mindset to process that, right, is that this is not just a commodity. It's not just a product that's interchangeable, but it's something that comes from a specific place, has a particular heritage. As Zach mentioned, you know, corn is so dependent on human intervention. And so as soon as you talk about what is corn, what is the flavor of this variety, it has to be expressive of the people that grew it and harvested it, and then in turn the people that distilled it. And it's just such a very different way of approaching something like whiskey. And I think it's something that's a teachable experience for consumers. And I think that as much as I enjoy whiskey because it tastes good and it's fun and it makes you feel good, I think this is also an opportunity to see, oh, this is something that can really show us how agriculture works and to kind of let us understand a little more deeply how heritage and agricultural heritage works and what that can mean and how transformative that can be for a culture.
That's amazing. I think about all the foods that I love. I think about oysters in Maine versus oysters from Virginia.
Yeah.
Or you know, apples, the same apples grown in New York versus, you know, something in the South. That's really cool. Zach, do you guys talk about that in the restaurant or in your program?
We do. If you're curious and ask, you know, I think it always depends. You'll see customers that are always curious about it. And we're always happy to talk about it or show them the tortilla factory, which is right there, you know, but if you also just want to have a margarita, I guess that's fine too. We do try to promote it as much also to the restaurants, just so that they know, you know, they know the product they're working with and they know the history and the culture and just like all the work that goes behind the corn, just the corn, you know, I mean, the tortillas are a lot of work too, but just like all the work that goes into, you know, I think most of this corn is actually hand harvested. There's no machinery involved. So it's like, it's just something that it's great to be aware of and just share with whoever is interested.
Where did corn originate in Mexico?
It did. It originated from a plant called teosintle, which is a wild grass. And it kind of evolved from there. You know, every year you'd grow the larger one until it's now, I think I don't think it's the most planted crop, but it's the crop that produces the most yield in the world.
In places that you've been in Mexico, what's the number one product that comes out of those heritage corns?
Tortillas.
Yeah. And so how does whiskey distilling fit in? Is that going to be another market or is that going to be more corn grown?
I don't know, but I think hopefully where we want to go is that we get more people talking about it and we get more people interested in growing it. And so in having a family, instead of saying, hey, I'll go to California and grow strawberries, say, hey, what I have here is really special and I should continue that legacy, right? And hopefully we can help encourage those thoughts.
Well, Tiffany, do you see similarities with what Zach's saying with how importers have approached the mezcal eras in
Yeah,
different
I think
parts of Mexico.
Particularly when we're talking about terroir, that's something we bring up a lot in our tastings is exactly that, you know, we talk about espadine, right, being the most common type of agave you're going to see, particularly in Oaxaca. And you might have one grown in the vice, you might have one grown much higher up, and you're going to see the real difference between these two versus, you know, cultivated versus wild. All of these things make a huge difference in the final product. Ultimately, I think with mezcal, I think it comes down to kind of the hand of the maker, but terroir plays a huge, huge role in everything. I mean, a lot of what we drink, but without us really knowing it, right? Same as what we eat.
Do you guys want to say anything else about the Mize Nation, the corn whiskey that we had?
I think, you know, the corn, I don't know too much about it, to be honest with you, but I know Jonathan and Yira, who make it, they're really passionate and they're real advocates. And they're, I think, one of the examples in the industry for how to do it right and how to treat this ingredient right and the relationship with the farmers right. Their distillery is solar. It's all run on solar, which I think is pretty cool. Not a lot of places in their distilleries in Oaxaca. So I think that's really cool. And, you know, I've known Jonathan for a long time, and he's a really passionate guy that puts a lot of love into what he does. And I think, you know, you can definitely taste that in this whiskey.
Clay, I met Jonathan, maybe it was 2019, a woman I knew, Johanna Kolodny, co-hosted a corn symposium. I don't know if you remember that. It was kind of an intimate, very intense, everything corn from Mexico and other places. And Jonathan Barbieri was there, and I sat in on his whiskey tasting.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I'm blown away by what he and Yara have achieved. I think it's very cool. Their approach is both distinctive and also, I'd say, in line with what a lot of other distilleries are doing. I think it's very archetypal for what Mexican whiskey will be like. I also really dig, and Zach, I'm glad you brought this, they have a rye whiskey as well, which we're talking about corn, but, you know, rye is also a grain that is very dependent on, I guess, all grains, but rye is one that, because it's so prevalent in whiskey making, has often been sort of commodified and made into just this generic thing. But there are lots of varieties of rye, and rye is very sensitive to where it's grown and how it's grown. And so it's very much in line with what they do, that they're growing, that they're making a rye whiskey as well. And this rye, this is delicious. This is, I always say, you know, a corn whiskey needs, I think, at least for, you know, I'm a very bourbon-centric guy. And so I think of corn whiskey needs to have a lot of age on it to taste good. But I think a really well-made rye whiskey can be great at 9 months, a year, 2 years, when it's very grain forward and very grassy and herbal and, you know, just this almost funky kind of earthiness. And this is a great example of that. I think it's beautiful. I love it.
And so I'm tasting a grassiness and like some kind of spice.
Yeah.
Spiciness.
Yeah. Well, that's that rye coming through, is that rye spiciness. And, you know, you can make a bad
like
young rye.
Snappy.
Yeah, you can make a bad young rye, but I think a really good young rye is not a, you know, people kind of stick their nose up at a young bourbon, and there's something to that. But a young rye is a great thing.
And what are some American ryes that you like, young ryes that
you can reference? Some young ryes. You know, actually some of the upstate ryes, I think Copperseed does a great job with kind of a younger profile.
They were doing also a rye eau de vie in the
beginning. Yeah, exactly. And they still, you know, I mean, certainly by necessity, they were making younger ryes early on, but because of their process, and they're another one that they're very true to a hands-on, old school, analog way of making whiskey. And they're young, and they've stuck with that because they've been successful, and it's a very delicious, very tasty young rye. I like what they make. I love it, actually. It's really good.
Hearst Ranch, in collaboration with Whole Foods Market, is proud to be the presenting sponsor of The Farm Report, a special HRN series in collaboration with the National Young Farmers Coalition. Tune in each week to hear from farmers, policymakers, organizers, and food advocates about all the ways the Farm Bill directly impacts our lives, whether we realize it or not. They'll break down farm policy and talk to young farmers about what hangs in the balance for them as another farm bill gets made. Join the coalition to shift power and change policy for the next generation of growers and land stewards. The future of good food depends on it. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Clay, since I have you here, I didn't get to interview you for your last whiskey book, but looking back to the history of American spirits and bourbons, and take us back to a time when the bourbons were really, let's say, first coming into cities and other things? Was this 200 years ago? Give us the time and what the taste might have been.
Oh, wow. It's very, you know, it's...
And how
it's,
much corn... I'm not trying to find out how much corn do we have tasted.
Yeah, no, it's... I mean, it's weirdly hard to say in specifics because so much of it was not documented. So, I've been thinking about this a lot as some research projects that I have going on, but certainly before the Civil War, American whiskey was not a high-end, high-value thing, even though it was spread around the country, particularly down, you know, farmers in Kentucky would make it often just as currency, right? They trade it, but then they would increasingly sell it as a commodity. It would go down the rivers to New Orleans and then spread from there. But it was after the Civil War where it really started to pop and made its way to Europe. And even then there was a big disparity between kind of your garden variety, just whiskey, quote unquote, and then the higher end bourbon that was being made. And it's kind of like the difference between a commodity product today and a craft product. Bourbon was the craft product of its time. And people were, trying to develop something that was a little more sophisticated in its flavor profile. So actually moving away from an agricultural profile, a grainy profile, to something that was more like a cognac, more like a scotch. And I think over the next 100 years or so, with Prohibition being this big intervening period, that's where the whiskey went, to the point where it kind of became insipid and very boring. And I'd say the last 15 years have been really exciting because we've moved away from that. And it's not a devolution. It's not like people are saying, oh, let's make whiskey that's not good again. But it's how do we embrace some of that, those older ways of making whiskey, some of those more agriculture forward styles and approaches, and yet obviously also make something that's really good and that's approachable for a modern palate. So it's been an interesting sort of history to be able to document and to kind of watch.
And then just way back when did the American whiskey makers start making bourbon in your eyes with
barrels? I mean, that's tough, right? So, you know, people were making whiskey in Kentucky as soon as they arrived. It was something that if you were a farmer, you did because if you had surplus grain, that's how you saved that grain, the value of it. And you increased the value by distilling it. So every farmer had a still that they brought with them when they settled wherever, Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee, whatever. And it was only, say, well into, you know, probably the second or third decade of the 19th century where people started to market it as a product. And one of the things I think that made bourbon bourbon, and the reason why it's called bourbon, is because there was this overlay of French culture in the Ohio River Valley, right? It was settled by the French. It wasn't settled, or it was, you know, as far as white people coming in, it was French first. And then New Orleans was the exit point. So you had French culture at all these points, and people wanted an aged spirit that had a certain sophistication to it, or at least a palate that was like that. And so calling it bourbon had kind of a French name. It looked kind of like cognac. It was not a grape spirit, but it had that quality. And so a lot of what made early bourbon bourbon and helped kind of round out that category was this French influence that today we don't think about, even though it's still called bourbon. It has a French name to it, and yet we don't necessarily think of it that way. But it very much was modeled after cognac. And the idea that this is an old product, right? People would say it's not just bourbon, it's old bourbon. Right? That was really important. And even today, age is something that people emphasize, right? We want an older spirit because that's what we've been trained to think of.
Yeah. Do you guys have any questions for Clay?
Oh, so many. So many. Well, it's really interesting to hear so much of the history. Also, being someone who was born and raised in Northwest Indiana, a lot of stories of people making whiskey, of the barn dances and the parties and the moonshining that went on throughout, you know, way before I was born. But I still remember my grandparents talking about this, and, you know, it's a real part of history that kind of still exists in some ways. But something I have a question about is, you were saying that whiskey is, or bourbon being these original American spirits, but I always thought that was apple brandy.
Yeah, well, so when you think about what was originally made in the U.S., I suppose it's hard. It's hard to put a name on first, right?
Right. Exactly.
It's also not something that people at the time were thinking about, right? It's not like, oh, we're making the first, right? I think when I say that, what I mean is it's the first spirit that kind of is homegrown, right? So there are certain things that were imported in terms of, well, we have apples in Northern Europe and we're going to distill apples in North America. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we did. The sort of fruit brandy is a style that people brought along with them. You know, when I think about something like rye whiskey versus bourbon, rye certainly came first, and it's you know, largely because rye grew really well there, and it represented sort of an intermarriage of different styles. So one of the things I think makes whiskey in the U.S. so exciting or so interesting is that it is like a lot of things about American culture. It's this sort of mixing of different traditions. So it's both an English and Irish and Scottish distilling tradition melded with a northern German tradition. And I would also argue that there's eventually a strong African tradition that's brought in as well to distilling. And so, you know, for me, that kind of gives rye whiskey and whiskey a sort of, broadly speaking, like a pride of place. But you're right. I mean, there's brandy is always there kind of in the background. Like, hey, we're also here. we exist.
Yeah.
Zach, do you have a question for Clay or Tiffany?
I'm terrible at asking questions. I feel like,
but you like to talk, so that's okay.
That's cool.
That's good. This is a great show. I this was probably the perfect length, and I know we all have places to go, including some of us are going to sit at Roberta's and have a pretend sampling of all the food from Blanca because we know how to order from the menu. And I highly recommend for Roberta's in Bushwick, the OG location, and celebrating 15 years of Heritage Radio Network right here in the studio at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. So we're thrilled to be back with you guys. And Clay, once again, thanks for having you on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This article has stirred the pot a little bit because we're all kind of overlapping with Mexican spirits these days. And you're bringing us back to think about bourbons.
Oh, hey, you know, broaden the palate.
Yeah. And Zach, for you, I know when we put the show together, we were looking for who had these spirits, and I had a feeling that you would have some. So once again, how many of the Mexican whiskeys do you carry at Sober Masa?
Well, right now we have four, which is honestly, we got four when we first opened, and a lot of them are kind of slow movers, but I think there's a lot of new ones that are coming out, you know, like My East Nation's coming out this year. So I think we're overdue for a restock soon as well.
That's good. And Tiffany, once again, your import company, some of the Mezcal brands you carry and rum.
Absolutely.
And a couple of accounts in New York that carry them.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Sober Masa being one of our great accounts. We're here at Roberta's as well with Lopez Real Mezcal. You can find us in a lot of places in Brooklyn, Panzón. In the city, you can find us at Comodo and La Contenta. We also work with the brands Rayo Seco. The rum is called Furia, and we work with the Yolishpa called Siete Reyes. That is a Mexican Amaro. We also have a brand called Petro Tierra. That is a pulque fermented agave spirit from Nuevo León. That's very exciting. I recommend you check that out. You can get that at Duke's Liquor Box if you're looking to buy.
Great retail shop.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Retail partner, Bolzol.
Oh, the absolute best. We shout out to the Dukes guys. We love them.
Wow. And last question, one more question. Okay, yeast. You know, we were just in your article, I was thinking about, wow, just the Mexican corn whiskeys versus American bourbon. There's a lot of differences, but of course the ingredients. But then things like yeasts. What yeasts are used in the Mexican distilleries?
I believe a lot of them are just using what I guess, you know, sort of autochthonous, whatever's in the air, yeasts, sort of, you know, spontaneous yeast fermentation, which is the traditional way to make it, instead of inoculating it with a lab grown yeast or a store bought yeast, you just kind of let the yeast in the air do its thing. And the reason, obviously, you know, you're kind of leaving things up to fortune, but also that's traditionally how it's made. And any yeast that is local is going to be local, and that emphasizes the terroir. I mean, you can't get more.
It's like Cantillon.
Yeah, you can't
wild
get exactly you
in the air get, of the barn.
Yeah, it's like a cool ship. You can't get more local than that.
Yeah.
Wow. And Zach, you mentioned pulque as a starter.
Yeah, yeah. Some people use pulque. Well, we talked about it in tepache. They used to use it in bread as well. I don't know if anyone's inoculating their corn whiskey with pulque. I think that sounds Ooh. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Please, someone do that.
Jonathan, if you're listening.
Jonathan.
And last question, because I know we're all split. Okay, also, barrel age versus clay or terracotta. How does that play in with the different whiskeys?
Well, you know, clay imparts very little flavor. So a lot of that is just letting the whiskey rest and sort of do its thing on its own. Oxidize a little bit, let it let the various chemicals kind of come to a balance. Whereas barrel is going to impart a lot of change and really intersect with the chemicals, the compounds in the whiskey and the oxidation, and create a very different flavor profile. I don't think one is necessarily better than the other. I think you're going to end up with very different spirits. And that's, I think it's very cool that there are distillers out there who are saying, well, let's not do barrels. Let's do something else. And Grand Marnier, they also use some cacao nibs as flavoring, which is also a traditional way of flavoring fermented or distilled spirits in Mexico. And so I think that's also kind of a cool throwback. But all of these things are just different avenues for experimentation and development. And I want to celebrate anybody who's doing that and willing to say, let's try something different that's new, but also draws on tradition and things that we know work.
Well, again, thanks for coming on, Clay. And your article about Mexican corn whiskey caught my attention. So
wow.
Appreciate it. Zach at Sobremasa, thanks so much for coming on. Tiffany Collins from Las Chingonas Imports.
Anytime.
Big shout out. Thank you, Armin Spingen, our engineer and maestro. Thanks for everything you do. And again, celebrating 15 years of Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host of Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time. All right. Thank you.
Woo. All right.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.